This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN. Lebanon's Hezbollah is a Middle East powerhouse, but could COVID tame the party of God?
Hezbollah is under some of the greatest pressure that it's ever been in as a group with this combination of crises, whether it's economic, whether it's security, whether it's political, whether it's COVID related. It's all adding up.
That's ahead on the show. And how does religion motivate tennis superstar Novak Djokovic? First, as of Wednesday afternoon, Pope Francis is set to fly to Iraq next week, making an historic trip to a country still mired in sectarian conflict. It's going to be the first ever papal visit to one of the cradles of Christianity. Francis plans to meet Christian communities persecuted by the Islamic State group, and also with a local Ayatollah who commands the loyalty of millions of Iraqis. Dr. Rehan Ismail is with the Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies, and she joined me earlier.
This visit is definitely very significant for the Christian communities in Iraq. The Christian communities in Iraq have been persecuted. They have been targeted by ISIS, and for a very long time, they've been marginalized as well. So for the Pope to visit Iraq, that is seen as the Vatican showing solidarity with the Christians in Iraq. In fact, local Iraqi Christian leaders felt that it was so important to have him there to encourage Iraqi Christians to stay in Iraq, because we're looking at the numbers of Iraqi Christians. The number has dwindled over the years, and therefore it was seen as very important and quite significant.
Iraq was once one of the cradles of Christianity, and I gather for much of its history, a lot of very peaceful relations between Christians and Muslims. What are the numbers of Christians down to in Iraq?
Iraq used to boast quite a vibrant number and also various Christian communities. At one point, it had 1.5 million Christians in Iraq. However, over the years, particularly in the last two decades, the numbers have reduced significantly. Today, according to some estimates, you only have 400,000 Iraqi Christians left. Many have fled the sectarian conflict, others have fled Saddam Hussein's regime, and more recently we're looking at ISIS as well, and many have been targeted by ISIS and therefore they have left Iraq.
What is the significance also of Pope Francis wanting to meet with the leader of the Shia community, Ayatollah Sistani?
That's a very good question, Andrew, and this shows Pope Francis' determination to promote interfaith dialogue. If you look at his track records, he's known for promoting interfaith dialogue. He has met with the Muslim leader or the prominent, you know, religious scholar in Egypt. He was in the UAE promoting interfaith dialogue as well. And that's part of his vision to promote cross-religious solidarity with the Muslim community in general or the Muslim world in general. And meeting with Ali Sistani is seen as quite significant in his efforts to promote interfaith dialogue. Ali Sistani is a prominent Shiite leader, not just in Iraq, but also in the Shiite world in general. He is followed by the Shia in Saudi Arabia, some Shia in Iran, some Shia in Bahrain. So we're looking at someone who's very prominent within the Shia community. And therefore, this is seen as quite significant for Pope Francis to demonstrate solidarity with the Shia in Iraq, but also the Shia world in general.
I also just wonder, Rehan, though, whether a meeting by Ayatollah al-Sistani with Pope Francis opens a gateway to the West for the Ayatollah there in Iraq.
Sistani has been cooperating with Western leaders as well. I think in 2005, he encouraged everyone to go out and vote in Iraq's first democratic election. So he has been very good in fostering relations with Western leaders. In fact, he himself has promoted peaceful transitions in Iraq, promoting a more democratic process in Iraq, and has been quite vocal against sectarianism in Iraq. So he has the respect of a number of Western leaders as well. Some US military officials who traveled to Iraq would often meet with Ali al-Sistani, because that shows that they have a bit of credibility when they're actually engaging with someone like Ali al-Sistani. So Pope Francis' visit, for example, would only enhance that reputation. Here you have someone who's quite committed to, you know, bridging the gap between the West and the Muslim world.
What message is the Pope sending by his visit to this ancient city of Ur?
I think this is fascinating because other popes have tried to visit the city as well. And in fact, in the year 2000, John Paul II scheduled a trip to Iraq, but that was cancelled due to regional tensions. And apparently he wept because he couldn't go. It shows the significance of this city for Christians, but not only Christians, Muslims and also Jews.
Yes, because I think it was the birthplace of Abraham, who is considered the father of the three Abrahamic faiths, Christianity,
Absolutely.
Judaism and Islam.
Absolutely. So this visit will be very significant, and it will demonstrate that Christians, Jews and Muslims originated from the same source.
Is there anyone who, or any interest group or any sectarian group in Iraq who would not want Pope Francis to be there?
One could argue ISIS. People are talking about ISIS as a group that has been defeated, but we're also looking at the resurgence of ISIS in Iraq. Only in January, they attacked Baghdad. So there was a twin suicide bombing in Baghdad, which killed more than 30 people and injured more than 100 people. So we're looking at small-scale insurgencies in Iraq. So obviously, ISIS will not welcome that visit. Shiite militias, on the other hand, because they're very respectful towards Ali al-Sistani, and the Pope is not really a controversial figure, at least in Iraq. And therefore, I don't think Shiite militias would actually be very unhappy with the Pope's visit. In fact, some Christian leaders are quite pleased that Shiite militias would also offer security to Christian communities, but also the Pope, just ensuring that he has a smooth visit. So again, I think the main threat would be ISIS, but I do think that the Iraqi government, as well as Shiite militia groups, will ensure the protection of the Pope and his entourage.
Just finally, Rehan, I wonder if the Pope's decision to go into what is still a low-level conflict region, one which is threatened, as you say, by persistent attacks from the remnants of ISIS, but also go in there at the time of a pandemic, sends a message that long-term peace is possible in Iraq. If the Pope is willing to go, the rest of the world should take a punt on long-term peace there. I'm thinking about the big reverberations of this visit.
It's a symbolic visit. It's important for the world to actually see that Iraq is a place where people promote cross-sectarian solidarity, interfaith dialogue, and this visit is so important. However, looking at Iraq's security at the moment, it's not very conducive to visit Iraq. We're also looking at protest movements in Iraq, because since October 2019, young Iraqis, particularly in the south, have been protesting against the government. So again, this is another issue in Iraq, because they're protesting against the political class in Iraq, accused of being corrupt. They're also protesting against the debilitating infrastructure in Iraq, lack of opportunities for young people. So we're looking at a country that is still struggling in terms of its security, but also providing stability to ordinary citizens. And in fact, there are reports that the government has been quite brutal in tackling these protest movements.
Dr. Rehan Ismail of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies. And it was great to have Rehan back. She was an ABC Top 5 Humanities Scholar in 2019. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Now, staying in the region, whether you see it as a terrorist group or a welfare agency, Lebanon's Hezbollah is a major player in the Middle East. The Shiite movement is also known as the Party of God, a fixture of Lebanese politics since 1992. Hezbollah also crosses borders, getting involved in Syria and Yemen. But a string of crises might curb its reach. Thomas Abihana is a global security analyst with Stratfor, a leading geopolitical intelligence platform. He's written a new paper on Hezbollah and joined me from Austin, Texas.
Hezbollah is under a lot of pressure right now in Lebanon, under some of the greatest pressure that it's ever been in as a group with this combination of crises, whether it's economic, whether it's security, whether it's political, whether it's COVID related. It's all adding up. As Hezbollah is facing all of these domestic crises, it's going to have to focus more domestically than it does regionally or internationally. That doesn't mean that it's going to completely stop being active around the world. It's just the group only has a certain amount of bandwidth, and more of that is going to be focused at home.
So what would the pressing domestic concerns be for Hezbollah now?
One is political. The group itself is designated a terrorist organization by the U.S. and other actors. It is, however, a political party in the Lebanese government. And right now, the Lebanese parties are actually trying to form a government. And so the group is actively involved in that process. The group is also facing a lot of economic burdens. It maintains de facto control over large parts of southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley, where it provides goods and services to a lot of the people there. And then also, it's tried to take a leading role in the COVID crisis in Lebanon. Like everywhere else in the world, Lebanon has been especially hard hit by the COVID crisis, and Hezbollah actually has medical facilities and doctors and hospitals that it actually employs to try to curb the impact of the crisis. So those are just three things that Hezbollah is having to deal with. Everyone's been equally impacted. It's just that right now, Hezbollah is more powerful domestically in Lebanon than it's been in the past. Therefore, it has to assume a greater burden than it's ever had before.
When you say it's more powerful domestically in the past, I mean, what has given rise to this newfound domestic power? It's always been, since the early 80s, a player. How has the crisis allowed it to emerge more powerfully?
I would say three ways. The first one is just politically. Whenever the group was founded in the 1980s, it was simply a militia. And going through the 90s and the 2000s, it became a part of the Lebanese government. So it went from being a non-state actor to a part of the actual government itself. The second thing is their security apparatus. The group has a powerful counterintelligence apparatus, communication system, and a rocket and missile arsenal that most estimates say is over 120,000 rockets and missiles, which makes it one of the biggest non-state military actors in the world. And then the third thing is something we mentioned in the past as well, the social and economic programs. Hezbollah does actually provide education and medical services and other things to people in areas where the group exerts its influences in Lebanon. Having been to Lebanon multiple times in the past, driving through southern Lebanon, you see more Hezbollah flags than you do actually Lebanese flags.
Yeah, you say that you expect a new surge of protest that's guaranteed in Lebanon. We've just seen these waves of protest since COVID, since the economic collapse, but then, of course, most pronounced since the explosion in Beirut at the port. Will that sort of civil unrest continue to strengthen Hezbollah?
I think it can both strengthen the group, but also potentially pose a threat to the group. In the past, there have been these waves of protests that really kicked off in October of 2019. Some of those protests, Hezbollah has actually tried to leverage for its own good in saying, this is generalized speaking here, essentially, the central government isn't providing for you, let us provide for you. However, it can also come to be a potential burden on them because now, like I mentioned, the group itself is part of the government. Yeah. if it tries to balance that tightrope of distinguishing between itself and the government, it's difficult to do that. That argument might work for some, but as we saw in the protests over the last year and a half, some of the protests have actually been directed at Hezbollah itself.
We know that Hezbollah has its tentacles around the region. But you also argue, I think, Thomas, that the COVID crisis will cause some drawdown. Now, where do you expect that to occur?
So I would say the main place that we would see that would be in Syria. The group intervened on behalf of the Assad government in the mid-2010s in order to support it in the Syrian civil war. And Hezbollah only has a certain amount of manpower and resources that it can expend to really anywhere around the globe. The two places that it is strongest in are, one, Lebanon, because that's its home base, obviously, and then two, in Syria, where it's deployed those fighters and those resources. So if you did see a drawdown by Hezbollah anywhere, it would be from Syria back into Lebanon.
One really surprising point that comes out of your piece is that we know that Hezbollah is obviously very active in the south of Lebanon, especially along the border with Israel. How has the COVID crisis, though, affected relations and tensions along that border?
It's difficult to say that the COVID crisis itself has made Lebanon and Israel, any more or less amenable to improving relations with one another. There are two different ways you have to look at it. One is between the Lebanese government and the Israeli government. And then two is Hezbollah as an independent military actor and the Israeli government. But I do think that in just looking at how each side calculates what they stand to gain and what they stand to lose, everyone's been hurt economically by COVID. And so these actors, whether it's the Lebanese government, Israeli government, or Hezbollah itself, they know that if they get into any kind of conflict reaching close to what we saw in 2006, that would economically devastate an already economically devastated economy. I would say if COVID did have an impact on those relations, it would actually make them less likely to want to engage in a conflict.
But I'm also thinking, Thomas, that if Hezbollah has to redirect its resources back to the domestic front, to its hospitals, to its schools, to its social service organizations, does this make it less confrontational on the question of Israel? Because I notice border negotiations between Israel and Lebanon began last October, and Hezbollah did not stand in the way of those.
That is correct. And you actually had the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, come out and say, essentially, yes, these talks can happen, in so many words. However, those talks have since been suspended because the two sides actually couldn't agree on what exact border they were negotiating over. However, it was a significant step forward for Hezbollah to actually say, yes, these talks can take place. That the status of those talks going forward, it's a question mark. It's up in the air. But the fact that Hezbollah let them take place in the first place is notable.
Thomas Abihana of the Geopolitical Intelligence Group Stratfor. And you're with Andrew West. Our interview last week with Keith Windschuttle about his book on Cardinal George Pell was, as expected, controversial. There are different perspectives on some of the issues he raised. We're happy to share those. Just go to the Religion and Ethics Report homepage and look for the program of the 17th of February.
Make it nine for Novak. A flawless display in the final.
That's a little of the excitement as Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic won his ninth men's title at the Australian Open this week. But for Djokovic personally, there's only one title that counts, his Serbian Orthodox faith. We asked the ABC's top sports analyst, Tracy Holmes, to explain.
He's extremely religious, and I think you need to go back to how he kind of developed as a man in his early childhood even, because he grew up through that era when his country was effectively at civil war. You know, it was the undoing of Yugoslavia, it was Croatia versus Serbia. He was sent to the mountains a lot to reside with his grandfather while his parents continued to work in Belgrade. And he spent a lot of time around older people, religious people. He was listening to very adult conversations. So as a human being, as opposed to a tennis player, Novak Djokovic is very aware of what's going on in the world. He taps into other discussions. He doesn't just accept what he's told. So he likes to meditate, investigate, challenge the status quo. And as part of that, he has become very religious, and I think even more so after he married his wife, Yelena.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you see that he holds the cross around his neck, he looks up to the skies, he prays.
Very publicly.
Very publicly, and in breaks when he's sitting on the chair where you have others throwing water bottles around and shoving bananas down their throat, Novak Djokovic can be seen sitting there deep breathing, meditating, praying. So he's very aware of that as a person. And I think that helps center him.
Yeah. Mm. I think he said the only title that really mattered to him was that of Serbian Orthodox Christian.
Yes. He's a man that continues to astound people, and I think people aren't used to that from athletes, particularly not tennis players, who start at such a young age that all they really know is tennis. And the only answers they ever give pretty much relate to tennis. Whereas you can ask Djokovic a question and you don't know where that's going to lead, whether that's going to lead to discussions about whether vaccinations should be accepted, to, you know, much broader issues. And he has a foundation that is very much concerned with these sorts of things. He's very into early education of children from communities who may not be able to afford education. He's built a number of schools. He's helped something like 20,000 plus young students in his country. He has built restaurants. He feeds the poor for free. He's a vegan. He obviously spends a lot of time immersed in a world other than playing tennis, which most tennis players do.
Yeah, I saw that the Patriarch of Serbia had congratulated Novak Djokovic on his win. I suspect, you know, that's even more important to him than, you know, the president of the Olympic Committee or the Tennis Federation, Tracy.
Yeah,
well, I do. I think he probably does take that to heart.
Absolutely. I think you're spot on with that. There's a man called Chris Bowers that's been following tennis and the tennis circuit for many, many years. He's authored many books on athletes, and one of them was the book on Djokovic. It's called The Sporting Statesman, Novak Djokovic and the Rise of Serbia. And I can recommend that because essentially he says the public face of Serbia since the Civil War has been Novak Djokovic. He grew up in that. He emerged from it. And the only face we know other than what went on there and the terrible atrocities that were committed at that time is Djokovic. So he's carried the responsibility of the nation, if you like, in a very public way. And he's always been very aware of that. He's one of those people who you would have to say he was born old. And so even when he was very young, he was 5 years of age when his parents were working in the little pizza restaurant they had. And he stuck his gaze and his nose through the mesh fence across the road at this tennis court. And there was a woman there coaching anyway in the half-time break. It was a summer school camp. She came across to the fence and said to this little kid, you know, do you know what this is? And his answer was, of course I know what it is. It's tennis. And she said, well, would you like to come and participate? And he said, well, yeah, I was wondering why it took you so long to ask. I mean, to think
he
this came out
precocious.
Of the... Very precocious. But what impressed this coach was that he turned up after lunch with a bag packed. He had towels in there, had a water bottle in there. He was just waiting for the invitation. And in fact, it was that lady who introduced him. Her name was Yelena Gencic. She introduced him to things like classical music, to politics, saying to him, you need to center yourself between points. Don't think tennis matches everything. You've got to be involved in the world.
Yeah, Tracy, given his strong Serbian Orthodox faith, do we know, though, if on the political level he's a bit of a Serbian nationalist? I mean, because that it often the two accompany each other in the Balkans, doesn't it?
Well, they certainly do. It's very difficult to know, because while he very much carries the flag of Serbia on his back wherever he goes, and he's very conscious of representing his country, he's also been known to support Croatia in football matches when Serbia's not there.
Ah, right.
And okay, so a lot of people have criticised him for that. And he has said, look, as a person who's been fortunate enough to be able to travel the world and to visit many different countries and to meet many different people, we need to be aware that everything is not always as it seems, and that in the end, people are people. And we want the world to be peaceful. I think most of his agenda is linked to this, you know, pursuit of peace, to make the world better, which is why he also spends, even though he's very strongly aligned with his faith, when he goes to Wimbledon every year, he's known to go to the local Buddhist monastery, and he knows a number of the monks by name, and he spends time meditating there.
I know that he actually lives in Monte Carlo, but do you think there's a sort of, given his strong religious faith, his patriotism, do you think there's a political future for Djokovic, Imran Khan style?
A lot of people suggest that in Serbia.
Really?
Yeah, so I think you've hit the money right on the head there. What will he do otherwise? He clearly wants to compete for a few more years. He's at the older end now, along with Federer and Nadal. They're into their 30s. But a lot of people have said, given his stature, his reputation, the love in which he's held back home in Serbia, that it will be a political career for Djokovic when he retires.
Yeah, just finally, you mentioned in passing the vaccination thing. And, you know, during the tournament, whenever vaccinations or COVID were mentioned, there was booing on the court. The official position of the Orthodox Church is not to oppose vaccinations. What does he put his anti-vaccination stance down to?
Well, he's not anti-vax.
Oh, he's not.
He's not anti-vax, but he does say, he spends a lot of time, he was one of the early adopters of the vegan diet. He wrote a book about it very early on, before it became trendy. And he's very conscious of maximising, getting the best out of your body, being physically healthy and well. And so he always takes that into account, and he wrestles with this idea. And he says, of course, if he has to have the vaccination to be able to travel and compete, he will. But he does wrestle with this idea that if you're healthy and there is nothing wrong with you and your body is able to fight sickness, why would you willingly put sickness into it in order to try and build this vaccination result? So he thinks about that with his children, and he wrestles with the idea. But he says he's not anti-vax, but he does think about that. He's very conscious of what goes into his body and his mind, for that matter.
Great to clear that up, and great to have you, Tracy. Tracy Holmes, one of Australia's top sports commentators and journalists here at the ABC. Thanks so much for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report, Tracy.
It's been wonderful. I never thought I'd be invited onto this show. Andrew, thank you.
And that is the program for this week. We're at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, we've had some inquiries about a fascinating series of seminars that are happening online. They're presented by a group called Heart Edge in cooperation with the Anglican Diocese of Melbourne and Brisbane. If you go to our website, you'll find a link to that series of seminars. Well, thanks this week to Mudita Dias and Emrys Cronin. I'm Andrew West, and the Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.